Strong, and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Dan Friedel. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Today on the program, Dorothy Gundy and I bring you the Higher Education Report. We look at three recent incidents where American college students were killed on campus. And we ask international students what they think of violence at colleges and universities in the U.S. After that, Andrew Smith has words and their stories. Andrew's discussion this week is about the way we talk about having a lot of something or something that is easy to reach. You might be surprised that it leads to a discussion about fruit trees. And finally, Kelly Jean Kelly brings us America's Presidents, about the first son of a former president to become president himself, John Quincy Adams. Now, here's the Higher Education Report. Gun violence can happen anywhere in the United States. It can happen at a school for children, a holiday parade, or a food store. It can also happen on college campuses. In February, a gunman came onto the grounds of Michigan State University and killed three people and hurt five others. Last November, three University of Virginia students were killed by a classmate as they returned from a group trip to Washington, D.C. Different kinds of violence can also strike universities. Last autumn, someone with a knife killed four students from the University of Idaho as they slept in their home near the school. Investigators are still working on the case in Idaho. In Michigan, the man who shot the students later killed himself. In Virginia, police arrested the student who shot his classmates.
There have been nine mass shootings at or around American colleges since 1966. That information comes from the Violence Project. The group defines a mass shooting as one in which four or more people are murdered in public in a single incident. The deadliest was at Virginia Tech in 2007. In that attack, a student killed 32 people and wounded 17 others. 15 years later, some laws and rules have been changed, but shootings still happen. How does the risk of such violence affect international students coming to the United States? And how does it affect the people whose job it is to recruit such students? VOA Learning English spoke with two international students and a member of one university's international programs team to find out.
Bo Benson recruits international students at Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts. The university has one of the largest populations of international students in the country. After a shooting like the one at Michigan State, Benson said, people thinking about coming to the U.S. for their studies have more questions about safety. Benson said, worried parents ask, will my son or daughter be safe if I send them halfway around the world? Benson notes, however, that the questions change depending on news events and international politics. Earlier in his career, international students and their parents were more worried about feeling welcome in the U.S.
And it's really, I would say, in the last few weeks or months, the whole topic of gun violence has come up again.
Kartik Sundaram and Kushi Agnish are both from India. They currently are in school or work on college campuses in the United States. Sundaram studies the behavior of internet users at the University of Michigan. Agnish recently finished her studies at Quinnipiac University in Connecticut. She now works as a researcher at Yale University.
Sundaram lives in Ann Arbor, Michigan. That is about 100 kilometers from the Michigan State University campus. He called the Michigan State shooting tragic. But it's kind of out of our control, he added. There's nothing really I can do about it, and there's no point in wasting my mental resources thinking about it. Sundaram said that if a person with a gun did come to his classroom, then I'm dead. Agnish has experience at two American universities. She said the environment at Quinnipiac is very different than the one at Yale, even though they are only 15 minutes apart. Yale is in the city of New Haven, and people can walk onto the campus without much trouble. Quinnipiac, on the other hand, is in the suburban city of Hamden. It is next to a large state park and separated from homes and business areas. She said anyone who drives a car must show their school identification card in order to enter the campus. At Yale, people need a student card to enter buildings. Agnish said she worries about crime and sometimes feels less safe in New Haven than she did in India.
A lot of people know that India is not considered a very safe country, but to be honest, living in New Haven made me feel a bit like maybe I was safer back home. And I would say that because in India, the most that would happen is I could get kidnapped or something, right? Like someone could just pick me up, take me, hold me hostage or something. But in America, I fear sometimes someone might just shoot me.
Agnish said sometimes she worries she could be a target because of her skin color. There is a constant fear because of the gun laws in this country that if someone gets mad at you, they can just shoot you, she said. Both the students and Benson, the recruiter, are unsure if the recent violence at American universities will make future students consider higher education in countries other than the U.S. Sundaram said he believes the benefit of studying in the U.S. outweighs the risk. The opportunity to make much more money was the dominant factor, he added. Benson, however, worries that some international students may be turned off by the violence and the high cost of attending school in the United States. Universities in places like Canada, Australia, and Northern Europe are considered safer and usually have a lower cost of attendance. He tells students that Boston is a safe place for international students and that Northeastern works hard to keep its campus safe. For Agnish, she said she only really learned about gun violence in America during her first year in the U.S., she said, "Such events were not talked about much in the news in India." So when she was considering coming to the U.S. for school, she did not think much about her safety. But, Agnish said, "If I was asked now, I might think twice before making a decision." I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. Have you ever gone to a farm or an orchard to pick fruit? Was all of the fruit easy to pick, or were some pieces easier to reach than others? Perhaps there were some apples in a tree that were too high for you to reach. And maybe you saw that others had picked the easiest fruit to reach before you. Today's words and their stories, however, is not about fruit, but about ideas. If you are the first person to arrive at an apple tree during harvest time, you can easily find some low-hanging fruit. These are the apples that are on the branches closest to the ground. Low-hanging fruit describes the most obvious or easiest things to do to help you reach a goal. The problem with low-hanging fruit is that it is easy for others to get there first, too. People who try to create new music, TV shows, or movies sometimes face this problem. They might believe that the best melodies and story ideas have already been taken. Some songwriters or scriptwriters might say that the creative low-hanging fruit has already been picked. When most of the fruit, ideas, or things that we desire have already been taken, we can say that the remains are slim pickings. This means there are only a few useful things left to choose from. And when almost nothing of value remains, we are scraping the bottom of the barrel. That means we are trying to get the last little bits. There is nothing but scraps left. Scraps are small, unwanted pieces that remain at the end of a process, like bits of food remaining after making or eating a meal. The scraps are often given to animals or thrown away. So, if you have nothing but scraps, it means you have the least valuable things, worth almost nothing to most people. When there is nothing left of something we need, like water, we must solve the problem. One answer is to dig a well to reach water underground. Some wells can last for many years, but others run dry. When the well has run dry, there is nothing left. Paul Simon is a famous American songwriter. In 2007, he told a reporter, "I think there's a certain reservoir of melody that you are born with, and in the beginning, you draw on that. And then, after a while, a relatively short while, you use it up." A reservoir is a place where water is stored, such as a pool, a pond, or a lake. Simon added that when the artist has used all that is in the reservoir, he or she needs to expand their skills. Otherwise, their creative well is going to run dry. So far, we have talked about running out of ideas. But what happens if you get lucky and find a lot of something valuable, like oil or gold? In those cases, you have hit the motherlode. The term motherlode came from California after gold was discovered there in 1848. It describes a narrow area of rock in the state about 190 kilometers in length. This rock was the source, or mother, of the gold found in rivers and streams in the area. Is VOA Learning English your mother lode for learning new idioms and expressions? Let us know in the comments below. And be sure to keep reading Words and Their Stories. I'm Andrew Smith.
I'm Dan Friedel, and you're listening to the Learning English broadcast. You just heard Andrew Smith's story about expressions related to having a lot of something or a lack of something. Andrew is here now to talk about fruit.
Well, Dan, not fruit exactly. More about that feeling you have when you have so many good ideas. It is like walking through an orchard where all the apples are within reach.
Andrew, I know. I'm just being a little strict. Like when you compare apples to apples instead of apples to oranges. So you discussed something the famous American singer and songwriter Paul Simon said about creativity and the well running dry. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Sure. Simon talked about using up a supply of ideas, in his case, musical ideas, and then finding new sources. The new sources are like another fruit tree or another well. I think both low-hanging fruit and a well that runs dry are useful metaphors when talking about creativity. So metaphor, and that's spelled M-E-T-A-P-H-O-R. Metaphor means using an image, a physical image, to help us think about something more abstract, like ideas. So, for example, we can say the light bulb went on to mean that a solution or creative idea came into our mind. I'm sure many of our listeners can think of situations where they feel their ideas have run dry, like a well that has no more water. But then other times when the juices are flowing. Now, to say the juices are flowing means they feel lots of creative energy. It's a nice feeling to have.
That's right. But sometimes it takes a little strong coffee to get the juices flowing for me, especially early in the morning.
I know what you mean, Dan. Sometimes I feel like I am scraping the bottom of the barrel if I don't have any coffee.
You know, that reminds me. I'll add coffee to my shopping list today. I don't want to run out. Thanks for chatting today, Andrew, and thanks for a good story.
You're welcome, Dan. Anytime.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about John Quincy Adams. Does his name sound familiar? John Quincy Adams, the sixth president, was the son of John Adams, the second president. Like his father, Quincy Adams had a sharp mind and a difficult personality. And, like his father, Quincy Adams served only one 4-year term as president. But Quincy Adams went on to have many successful years working in a different job. He is the only former president, so far, to serve in the House of Representatives. The parents of John Quincy Adams, John and Abigail, were strong patriots. Theirs was one of the founding families of the United States. Abigail Adams especially raised her son to serve his country. She expected him to become president. She told him that, with his good education and training, if he did not serve in a high public office, it would be his own fault. Quincy Adams did not disappoint his mother. As a child, he learned to speak at least 4 languages and read Greek and Latin. He also studied Shakespeare's plays. At age 10, he traveled with his father to Europe. As a young man, he worked alongside John Adams in American diplomatic offices in Paris, Amsterdam, and St. Petersburg. Finally, Quincy Adams returned to his home in Boston in time to graduate from Harvard. He was working as a lawyer by the age of 23. Stories confirm that Quincy Adams was a brilliant boy and young man, but he rarely compromised his ideas. His inability to work with other lawmakers and to consider public opinion were partly to blame for his difficult presidency. Quincy Adams may have been a poor politician, but he was an excellent diplomat. In the early part of his career, he served as the American ambassador to the Netherlands, Germany, Russia, and Britain. He helped lead the negotiations that ended the War of 1812, and he served for 8 years as Secretary of State under James Monroe. Some of that president's accomplishments owe a lot to Quincy Adams. He helped negotiate the purchase of Florida from Spain, and he was one of the people responsible for the Monroe Doctrine. It warned Europe not to interfere in the Western Hemisphere. But Quincy Adams could be impatient, especially with lawmakers. Many of them, he believed, did not care much about the country and wanted to help only themselves. Quincy Adams also avoided political battles. As Secretary of State, he appointed people whom he thought were capable, even if they did not support his political party. Similarly, when he became president, he tried to bring political opponents, along with representatives of different parts of the country, together in his cabinet. His opponents, however, refused to serve, and although his cabinet included Southerners, he did not really have the support of the South. Yet, Yet Quincy Adams talked about unity in his presidential inaugural speech. Adams said, "The Constitution and the representative democracy of the United States had proved a success. The nation was free and strong and stretched across the continent from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific." He noted that political divisions had eased. So now, he said, it was time for the people to settle their differences and make a truly national government. In his first message to Congress, President Adams described his ideas. The chief purpose of the government, he said, was to improve the lives of the people it governed. To do this, he offered a national program of building roads and canals. He also proposed a national university and a national scientific center. Adams said Congress should not be limited to making laws only to improve the nation's economic life. He said it should make laws to improve the arts and sciences, too. But many people of the West and South did not believe that the Constitution gave the federal government the power to do all these things. They believed these powers belonged to the states. Their representatives in Congress rejected the president's proposals. In addition, a new opposition party was trying to weaken support for Quincy Adams. They supported a general from Tennessee named Andrew Jackson. Historian Harlow Giles Unger says, "John Quincy Adams was never able to meet the high expectations many people had for him. His presidency was a complete failure," Unger told VOA. "He was able to accomplish nothing." Quincy Adams lost the presidential election of 1828 in a landslide. He refused to attend the inauguration of Andrew Jackson. He returned to his home in Quincy, Massachusetts, depressed and worried about the country. His wife, Louisa Catherine Johnson Adams, believed they were returning to Massachusetts to stay. She was an American, but was born in England. Her mother was British. She was, at the time, the first foreign-born First Lady. John and Louisa had four children, but their only daughter had died as a baby. Their sons were grown by the time Quincy Adams retired from the presidency. Soon he became restless. Some neighbors asked if Quincy Adams would consider representing the district as a member of the U.S. Congress. He agreed, but only if voters would let him act as he believed was right, instead of as what would be politically popular. Apparently, they agreed, too, because voters elected Quincy Adams to the House of Representatives 9 times. In Congress, Quincy Adams often fought for citizens' individual liberty. He also strongly opposed slavery. His ideas were not wildly popular at the time, especially among other lawmakers. They had created a rule that said Congress would not even consider any measures against slavery. Yet Quincy Adams defended the rights of enslaved people, frequently and sometimes successfully. He died at the age of 88, a few days after suffering a stroke on the floor of the House of Representatives. At the time, lawmakers were considering a proposal, and, as usual, John Quincy Adams was loudly voting no. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's the Learning English broadcast for today. Thank you for listening, and thanks to all my colleagues for their work on the program. I'm Dan Friedel.